Maybe not the best of news for people who want to see the solar eclipse. Partly sunny and warm. High today, 83. Partly sunny in meteorological terms means more clouds and sunshine. We'll have to see how that pans out here by the time the eclipse starts at 11:45 this morning. Right now, wind is calm, humidity 100%, 69 degrees at 10 past 8. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. The WGTD Morning Show with Greg Berg, up next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. And unless you've been living under a rock for quite some time, I'm guessing that you are already well aware of the fact that later today, much of North America will be experiencing a total eclipse or near total eclipse of the sun. It depends, of course, on exactly where you are, but there is a line right across the middle swath of North America where people will be able to view a total solar eclipse. And here in southeastern Wisconsin, we will see what will very much seem like a total eclipse. I mean, with the vast majority of the sun hidden by the moon and for some time. That'll happen early this afternoon. I'm really happy to be able to speak for a few minutes here with Dr. Julie Dahlstrom, who is Associate Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Carthage College, and she, as you can well imagine, has been fielding all kinds of questions about today's solar eclipse, and for all of the news stories that have been run, it's really interesting how there are still important questions that maybe have not yet been posed. So we're going to spend a few minutes talking about exactly what this celestial event means today, a few maybe closing remarks about how one can safely view today's event, and whatever else we managed to touch on along the way. Professor Julie Dahlstrom, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So glad that you're making time for this. Thank you. Just ahead of us talking about the solar eclipse, I would love to know a little bit about your own personal interest in astronomy. You're also a professor of physics, but particularly your interest in astronomy. Can you trace that to anything in particular that that got you really interested in the heavens above us?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. I know for a fact that when I was in seventh grade, I believe, I had a science teacher who got us thinking about possible career paths. And at that time, I had not even known that there was such a thing as an astronomer, that someone could actually do this for a living. And it literally had us pulling different options out of a card catalog. And, you know, when I found astronomy, I was just I knew instantaneously that that's what I wanted. I don't know why I knew it, but I just knew it. And some deep part of me, you know, had the desire to understand deeply what was going on in the cosmos. And so at that point, I kind of got myself on the right academic track. But there wasn't like a specific thing like a trip to a planetarium or to an observatory or looking up at the sky that got me thinking about it. At some level, it was already deeply rooted in me. I also have very fond, you know, and vivid memories of the original Cosmos series that came out when I was in high school. And that was incredibly formative for me to see this, you know, very learned and inspiring Carl Sagan speaking lyrically about the cosmos.
He really did, didn't he?
He did indeed.
Explain what Carthage offers in terms of study in astronomy.
Okay, so astronomy is part of our Department of Physics and Astronomy. We have on the books an astrophysics concentration, which would be the marriage, if you will, of physics and astronomy. Astronomy is generally a more empirical or phenomenological description of things going in the heavens. So the actual observations that would take place we would call astronomy, whereas the physics part is where the explanatory piece comes in. And so the astronomy that we do have an introductory astronomy class that we teach that's available really for any Carthage student to take who has an interest in it. We also have a planetarium, a new planetarium as part of our new science building that we use to do public outreach with, and we have open houses fairly regularly. And students are also able to, if they wish to, learn to operate the planetarium through a planetarium training class. And then finally, in astronomy, for those who wish to go on and delve more deeply, we have an astrophysics class at the 4,000 level, or for the senior level undergraduate. That would be predominantly for physics majors, as it requires quite a number of years of physics before you'd be ready for that class.
Hmm. I think one of the things that probably a lot of us don't fully grasp about astronomy, the study of astronomy, is what you were touching on about how much it intersects with other disciplines like physics. And I think for a lot of us who maybe fell in love with astronomy, it was all about how many moons does Saturn have, and and where is Cassiopeia, and what are the first magnitude stars, and it's kind of about observing and reveling in the beautiful objects that are above us in the night sky, and of course that's one part of it, but a relatively modest part of it, of course, when we're talking about the entire academic discipline of astronomy.
And yet it is also the piece that touches everybody, that we're all aware of this sky above us and can be inspired by it and can ask those really deep questions. One of my professional memberships is to the Astronomical Society of the Pacific that uses astronomy as sort of the gateway to an interest in all science. And I think, to me, that's how I think of astronomy, is it's really, if you will, sort of the intersection set of all of the sciences, including biology, including chemistry and geology, all of them come together in astronomy.
Mm. We're speaking with Dr. Julie Dahlstrom, who is Associate Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Carthage College. And what we will begin talking about right now is the event that has so much of the country's attention riveted. In fact, the attention of many people all around the world, namely today's total solar eclipse. I think most of our listeners are aware that a solar eclipse occurs when our moon passes, in a sense, in front of the sun and obscures the sun from view. A couple of general questions about that. How common are partial eclipses, and do some of them occur to such a modest degree that they occur without us even knowing about them or without it being mentioned on the evening news?
Oh yes, indeed. Actually, the conditions for eclipses are right really twice every single year. Where it occurs in what's called the line of nodes, or those two points where the lunar orbit around the Earth intersects the point where the Earth's orbits around the Sun. So they're two different planes, and they intersect. They're not quite coplanar. They are tilted just a little bit compared to each other. So it's really only one of those where those two planes come together that the moon could be in the right position to block the sun completely.
Interesting. Because otherwise they're on a completely different plane, and there's no possibility of the two bodies, in a sense, visually intersecting.
That's true, or they could be on exactly the same plane, in which case we would have eclipses every single year. The only question then is, part of the rarity is has to do with the shadow of the moon and how relatively small it is. If you think about it, the reason we see the eclipse is because the moon's shadow is falling directly on wherever it is we are. But the moon is much smaller than the Earth, and its shadow is quite small as well, and sometimes it misses the Earth, or it misses where we happen to be. So there are far more eclipses that happen than we would necessarily see in North America. I would say that there is another total solar eclipse in the year 2024. It's not so much that they're terribly uncommon, but part of the reason why they're not more common has to do with the size of the moon compared to the size of the Earth.
So it sounds like another striking feature of this particular eclipse, which I have seen described in a couple of places as the Great American Eclipse, is because the path is following this swath that's almost a perfect diagonal from the northwest down to the southeast, from Oregon down to South Carolina. And is this uncommon for, in a sense, the visual pathway of the total eclipse to swing through North America in this particular fashion?
Yes, indeed it is. There is no truly preferred location for the moon's shadow to fall. It can fall anywhere on the globe, and if you think about it, we're about two-thirds water, so oftentimes that eclipse shadow will fall over the ocean, and we would not be able to see it from land at all. So I believe it's a shame for basically anybody who can listen to me right now, that the next really, really good eclipse for southern Wisconsin would be in the year 2099, when we would, in Kenosha, be pretty much right in totality. But unfortunately, we won't be around to enjoy it.
Not very likely, yes.
No. Not unless some huge advances in medical science occur.
Right. And the pathway of the sun, of the moon's shadow, is that, in a sense, I was going to say a capricious thing. I'm sure it's not completely capricious, but is there much in the way of rhyme or reason in terms of is it very cyclical in terms of where that pathway is going to fall, or does it almost seem to be in sort of random fashion?
It probably appears to be random on a human time scale. We would not really notice many patterns, but it is cyclical in the long run. And it's easily calculable. So the predictions for eclipses, run out hundreds of years. It's very, very well understood. And as I say, they would, in the end, it would probably repeat. But it wouldn't be obvious in a human lifetime.
Right. In your community of astronomers, how many astronomers do you know who are planning to travel to the actual pathway through the middle of the United States where the eclipse can be viewed as a total eclipse? We know about all kinds of sort of regular folks who are seem to be planning to do that. Is that also something that serious astronomers are doing? And is that something that you were thinking of doing as well?
I was not thinking of doing it, although I think we're all drawn by that event, in the same way. We all want to witness it. They are uncommon, and you generally do have to travel a great distance to see one. I decided I was not going to because of the, you know, how close it was to the beginning of the school year. And I found that there was some interest at Carthage of having a local event. So I turned my attention to that. I'd say that the professionals who are traveling are not people who are engaged in a serious research initiative. Generally, they're going for personal reasons. The people who are more likely to go for, you know, more to observe and to take telescopes and to take records of it tend to be more the people involved in the education and outreach portion, and they're looking to share this experience with others as part of their mission. But no, I'd say the most professional astronomers, if they don't tend to go and travel to solar eclipses. I think it's very unusual. More of the solar observing that's done would not be done during an eclipse so much, but by orbiting satellites. And that's done, you know, every minute of every day of every month of every year.
Right.
So I think that's really where the bulk of the effort is for professional astronomers.
Right. In fact, I find myself prompted to ask, is there actually much that we learn from a total eclipse? I mean, in a sense, it seems like an eclipse is exactly the wrong time to be studying the sun because it's a moment when the sun is obscured from our view. And yet, are there ways in which we are seeing the sun in a different way in such an event that can be, in some respects, scientifically valuable?
Yes, I know that there is a mission during the North American eclipse to have a supersonic jet following the path of the eclipse so that they can observe the solar corona continuously for a longer period of time. So the corona is the outer atmosphere of the sun that is visible during a total eclipse, even by your eye. It's what, you know, corona would be equivalent to crown, right? So that's the spiky bit that encircles where the solar disk would normally be. And so by having appropriate mechanisms for observing the corona, you know, one might learn something about that outermost atmosphere of the sun just in normal visible light. Professional astronomers can observe the corona even when there is no eclipse, but generally they have to use X-rays, which is one of the types of light that the corona itself radiates natively. White light, what you would see from, you know, from your eye, for example, tends to be more reflected light and not so much light that's radiated natively. And so that part is generally obscured by the brilliance of the sun's disk. So there may be something to learn by observing the sun's corona in as I say, in sort of a continuous way. I think for most astronomers, we respond to this more in the same way that other people do. It can be a spiritual experience to see a total solar eclipse. It generally does make quite an impression on people who see one. I was speaking to Walter Smith, a professor of chemistry here at Carthage, who had gone to see a total solar eclipse in Africa, I think in 1980, and he just had, you know, profound memories of that, of having done that.
Where are you planning to view today's eclipse? I mean, exactly where will you be?
I will be at Carthage College, actually, and I will have, you know, a few small telescopes out with a couple of students. It'll just be just a few of us, and we can't accommodate a great number of folks, but if anybody's really, you know, needing some place to go and they absolutely want to see it, they can drop by.
I want to make sure we take a moment to talk about how regular citizens can safely view the eclipse. But hearing you talk about telescopes reminds me of when I owned my first and actually only telescope as a sixth or seventh grader. I remember looking at the sun through my telescope through some kind of protective lens that made everything look green, but allowed me to look right at the sun, which was felt like kind of a power trip. Pretty exciting to be able to do that safely. And is that, in a sense, the mechanism that allows you to look at the sun safely through a telescope, or has that technology changed?
Well, it's changed a little bit in that typically the filter is not placed at the eyepiece. It's placed actually at the entrance to the telescope now. There are several different variants of the filtering. One can be the same kind of white light filter that one might use for eclipse glasses, so a form of a mylar layer that usually looks reflective, looks silvery, and that would be placed right at the, you know, the far end of the telescope, the part that receives the light, and attenuates the sunlight that enters the telescope tube. In that case, then, it's safe to look through the eyepiece as you normally would. One other precaution to take with many telescopes would be to block off the finder scope or to remove the finder scope from the main scope. The reason for that is that the light that enters the finder scope can damage it or can become concentrated and hurt you. So it's tricky to aim a telescope at the sun, because you should not look at the sun while you're trying to do it. It's hard to aim at something that you can't look at. So one tactic is to look back behind you at the shadow of the telescope on the ground and keep reorienting the telescope in such a way that the shadow of the telescope is minimized.
Interesting.
So when you do that, then usually the sun's is fairly close to being in the field, if it isn't actually in the field. So that's definitely one approach. Another approach would be there are specialized solar telescopes called made by a company called MEED. They're called the Coronados. They operate with a narrow band hydrogen filter. It isolates one particular wavelength of light in the red that is a kind of light that's produced abundantly in the sun's outer atmosphere, in the what's called the chromosphere. And it allows you to see some of the prominences that emerge from the limb of the sun. So a lot of these loops that you may have seen in beautiful solar photography, you can see that just during the day with an ordinary telescope, if it's equipped with a hydrogen alpha filter.
Hmm. Of course, the average citizen today wanting to view the eclipse will not be looking at it through a telescope, but simply looking through what we hope are safe, protective viewers or glasses of one kind or another. Can you just, and I'm sure by now, if you don't have such glasses, you're not going to find such glasses. For the most part, they've been pretty much sold out of any local stores. But can you just say a word about how such protective glasses work? And maybe if somebody has those in their possession, is there a way for them to be absolutely certain that what they have are the kind of glasses that will give them adequate protection for today's event?
Okay, so the thing to look for with glasses that you may have purchased for the eclipse is, if they're paper-framed glasses, would be to look for the certification ISO, and then there's sort of a long number that ends in 2015. So there's a certification by agency called ISO that will have verified that the film that's used in the important part of the glass, the part that you look through, to prove that it attenuates the sunlight sufficiently that you will not burn your retinas by looking directly at the sun. The way you can tell, or one way you can tell whether the glasses are safe, is to look at, if you can look at any other bright thing, like a light bulb or what have you, the brightest thing that isn't the sun, if you can see it through the glasses you have, then it is not safe and you should not use those glasses. There is no safe exposure to sunlight with your eyes. You know, so you should never look at directly at the sun. You know, of course, we've all done this accidentally. You know, had a momentary glimpse of the sun, but there is really no safe exposure.
Right. So if somebody is, in fact, doing damage to their eye, even in such brief accidental moments, I mean, some kind of damage is inflicted on the eyes. I think that's what you're suggesting.
Yes. And if it's very, very momentary, then the eye will recover from it. The problem is that the part of the eye that's damaged is the retina, and it has no pain receptors. So you will not know how much damage you've done until it's too late.
Hmm.
So it's very important, you know, to be careful in that way. If you don't have eclipse glasses, the other way that's always safe is to use a pinhole camera, or to use a pinhole and just it's an ordinary index card. So the way this works, literally, you take a pin, you know, an index card, you punch a hole in it with a pin, and you orient the card such that the sun shines through the hole, and it creates a little image of the sun. And it's very, very small. It's not very, you know, glamorous, not very romantic appearing, but it is a safe way because you never actually look directly at the sun.
Right. So this pinhole projection method is really, I suppose, the absolute safest way to view today's event. I actually have fairly vivid memories of doing that, not with a total eclipse, but with a very, very significant total eclipse. My memory, it was maybe a good 60% or so, but probably back when I was 10, 11, 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But I
mm-hmm.
can remember looking at that card that my dad was holding and seeing that bright circular image of the sun, and then seeing the encroachment of that circle by the passing moon. And it's not quite the same. But
no.
It is one way to view something like this in perfect safety. Well, we certainly hope that wherever you are with some of your students today, that it is going to be as exciting for you as it is for us. And with fingers crossed for the weather, of course, cloud cover would be an unwelcome intrusion. I suppose even with cloud cover, we would still have some sense of something going on, right?
Yes, you would definitely notice that it is becoming darker during the maximum part of the eclipse, even if you can't see the sun directly. But let's hope that we do, you know, have at least breaks in the clouds so we have a good view. There is one other safety point I'd like to make,
yes.
If I may. The eclipse glasses, even the certified glasses, even the ones that are, you know, believed to be safe, it is important not to stare at the sun for more than, you know, a minute or 2 minutes at the most with those glasses, and then to look away and let your eyes recover. They're really not intended for continuous viewing of the sun for long periods of time, even the so-called safe glasses. So it's a relative safety for brief exposure. It's not safety for the long haul. So that's one thing. And also be aware that most of the paper frame glasses let a lot of light around the glasses themselves. There's still a lot of ambient light that comes in around them. And so, once again, just be aware that you should not plan to use them continuously for the whole event.
Very, very good advice, and I appreciate the other information that you've shared with us as well. Dr. Julie Dahlstrom, who is Associate Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Carthage College, thank you so much, and happy viewing.
My pleasure to be with you. But there, besides.
And it's 8:39 here on WGTD, and here is part two of Monday's Morning Show. All of us are surrounded, it seems, all the time, I mean, nearly 24 hours a day, by photography. It is a technology which is now riding around in our pockets, within the heart of our phones, all around us. It's one of the easiest things to utterly take for granted. which is just one of the reasons why I really encourage you to seek out an absolutely gorgeous and also massive book called Photography, The Definitive Visual History, in which we are shown the long and fascinating history of photography, of how it has developed and how various technological breakthroughs have changed the nature of photography, who has had access to it, and the way in which it has helped shape our world and shape our understanding of the world. The author of the book is Tom Ang. He has done a great deal of writing, created a number of different books in both digital and print media, and has been active in the field of photography for a long time, was for a time senior lecturer in photographic practice at the University of Westminster, London. And his wide-ranging expertise in photography serves him well in putting together this beautiful book published by DK. And I'm very pleased to be able to speak with Tom Ang about his book, again called Photography, The Definitive Visual History. Tom Ang, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's great to be on.
I wish so much that this weren't radio. I wish this was television. I very seldom wish that as I do interviews, but in this case, I would give just about anything to be able to hold up this book and have those who are listening to us see it with their own eyes. It's a real work of art and also full of fascinating information. As someone who already knew, of course, a great deal about photography, nevertheless, did you understand the scope and complexity of the challenge before you in putting together this kind of definitive history of photography?
I think, yeah, I've been studying and reading photography for 30 plus years. I think what really I found tricky, and you can imagine why when I tell you, was the need to provide some kind of context. You know, if you read what I say about the Great Depression, I think I summarized it in like two sentences, three sentences for the Great War, five sentences for the Vietnam War. That was a tough bit, to say something meaningful, which gave some kind of context and location for the photography and for the photographers that took place there. Yeah.
We should maybe mention that the book really does unfold chronologically. And one of the things that I most admire, besides just all the attention to detail here, is that you have come up with some very meaningful eras, a framework in terms of these decades being this for photography and these next decades representing something else. And they're not cleanly delineated 20 years here and 20 years there. But, I mean, you've clearly thought a lot about the history of photography and its various phases. And while some of them, like the dawn of photography, is pretty obvious, in many other cases, it seems to me you've really had to look long and hard in order to figure out what was most significant about photography in, for instance, the late 19th century.
Yeah. I thank you. Yes, I did look long and hard, and I also worked hard not to repeat the kind of institutionalized answers that we had for the history of photography. For me, it was important, for example, to give equal footing to the technologies of photography as to great photographers, something which hardly any history of photography does. Because for me, if we didn't have the cameras, the films, or the lenses, we couldn't make the pictures that we make. And for me, it was also important to highlight some of the neglected figures and to also actually incorporate some new research. For example, Roman Vishniak is celebrated for his photography of the Jews prior to their persecution in the Second World War. But some new research has actually thrown light on some of his motivations and some of his let's put it lapses in memory. And that kind of small detail, which illuminate the lives of photographers and the lives of people around them. Those were the little details which I was really looking for, which is not what I think classical art historians look for.
We're speaking with Tom Eng about his book, Photography, The Definitive Visual History. I want to ask you about one thing, but I wish we had time to talk in great detail about the beautiful introduction you've written to the book. Among many interesting things you say, you say at one point, compared to other arts developed over thousands of years, photography is still in its infancy. First of all, that was not exactly news to me, but I had never really stopped to ponder that. I wonder what the significance of that is, the fact that photography, although we think of it as having been around a long time, in fact is in its infancy.
I wish I knew the answer to that. When I was thinking about the history of photography, it struck me very early on that, thousands, millions of years ago, we may have started to chant and sing to each other. And now, here I am listening to a three-hour-long Wagner opera, whose roots go all the way down back to these fireside chants. And it made me realize that, actually, in terms of actual elapsed time, photography as an art, compared to, say, opera, is still at the fireside. We're still chanting. We're still figuring out what the hell we can do with this. Now, of course, our technologies and everything else are much more advanced. But in terms of how photography could develop, I think there's nothing but kind of exciting potential. And let me give you one example. In only 10 years, basically, we have gone from images being basically singular, in other words, they're on a print, only one person can see it at a time, to images being connected, to images which we can put onto the internet in one social media or another, and which could be seen by millions, potentially, at a time, and sometimes they are. Now, that's taken place in a very short space of time, and I tell you, I was writing future crystal ball reading articles 10, 15, 20 years ago, and I never got anywhere near the concept of the connected image. So, who knows what's just around the corner.
You write, clearly the best of photography is yet to come. I do have to say, for as much as your book enlightens us about some of these very recent developments. I mean, we all know, of course, about this dawn of digital photography. I mean, most of us use it all the time, but you also help us really understand its ramifications, and I so appreciate that. On the other hand, I'm very grateful for all that you tell us about the dawn of photography, about the way in which this technology first came into being. And while I was acquainted with the very first photograph taken back in 1826, an image you reproduce here, I didn't know about some of what had come just before it. For instance, this technology that involved something called the heliograph. In fact, you reproduce for us a heliograph from 1825, which in some ways could be called an even older photograph than the one I just mentioned. Just tell us a moment about this primitive technology that helped pave the way.
Well, the interesting thing about all the early inventions in photography is that they were pushed by guys who wanted to compensate for their lack of artistic ability. So the heliograph, for example, was Niepce thinking, well, look, I want to engrave, but actually, I'm useless at engraving. So what can I do to get the sun, to get some technology to do the work for me? And that's when he conceived of the possibility of actually using the light and the dark to produce light and dark in a printing plate. Basically, it was a It was a slab of rather sticky tar. But it was the same with Fox Talbot when he came back from holiday, and his wife and his children had produced some pretty drawings of Lake Como. And his were pretty pathetic, actually. And he thought, this is really pretty pathetic. What can I do to get nature to do the pencil work for me, which is why he called his first book Nature's Pencil. And it was the same with Daguerre. Daguerre was a set painter, and I think basically he got fed up of making paintings sets after sets for his theatre. So he wanted a mechanical way of doing it. And that's what these guys were all motivated by.
One of the most spectacular moments in the book is the first time we see a large reproduction of a particular photograph, and then we see off to the side the way in which you highlight various aspects of that photograph and help us understand what makes it notable. In this case, it's a very famous old photograph of a boulevard in Paris in 1838, and it helps us understand just what makes this photograph so notable. Say a word about it.
Yeah, the Boulevard du Temple is, first I have to tell you the story about it. It's tragic because the original daguerreotype was probably one of the early ones, which meant that actually it was a little bit scratchy. It wasn't polished to the quality that was introduced a couple of years later. So some helpful museum curator thought actually he'd clean it up. What he didn't realize, and he jolly well should have, is that a daguerreotype is basically just a thin layer of an amalgam of mercury on silver. It's extremely delicate. So, of course, when he tried to clean it, he totally destroyed it. But fortunately, the historian Beaumont Newhall had come across it and made a good film-based copy of it. And so that's what we have now. That's the only thing that's surviving. And the big controversy about that, about the picture, which we talk about in the book, is that it actually shows two people. And so everyone says, well, this is the first time people were ever photographed. And the question is then, were they set up or not?
Mm. We should remind people that we should remind people that we're talking about this Paris Boulevard, and then in the towards the foreground of the picture is the small figure of a man who appears to be having his shoe shined, and that solitary figure is all we see. Although presumably there are other people walking on the boulevard who do not appear because of the long exposure, but it's a striking photograph. Go ahead.
Indeed. This is where we want to be on TV, isn't it?
Right, exactly.
yes, the picture was taken in the morning, and the boulevard would have been full of people. But because there was a long exposure, probably in the region of 30 or to maybe even 60 seconds, everybody is blurred and disappears. But the two people who are relatively stationary, which is the guy having his shoe shined and a boy, do appear as shadows, but the big question is why he was shining his shoe right there. It's right on the corner of a boulevard where the pedestrian, sidewalk area, is almost as wide as the boulevard itself, and yet the shoe shine has and his client are positioned right on the street corner, where it's perfectly positioned for the photograph. So, you know, even in an old historical picture like this, there are controversies and questions.
Mm. What is striking?
I'll just finish off by saying, but what that picture shows is that Daguerre was an artist, he would have made a great photographer, I think, if it hadn't been for the fact that by giving away his invention to the French government gave him a nice annuity. And we hear nothing of him again, which is, I think, a real pity, because I think he would have been a really fine photographer.
Hmm. Your book goes on to describe various ways in which photographers came to sort of stretch the technology, develop new ones, and find new ways to utilize photography in things like capturing images of war. One of the most intriguing moments, actually, I want to just have you talk a moment about is a little chapter called Photographing Children. And, of course, back in the days when it took a long time to expose a given image in taking a photograph, it's one thing to have a stately gentleman stand still, but what about a child? You tell us there were some intriguing techniques by some photographers to keep children still and sedate.
There are handbooks of child photography from the time that give recipes for the amount of chloroform you could the strength of chloroform which are suitable for keeping the child still. Or subdued, they're not actually sending them off to heaven. And there were also contraptions to hold them still while being trapped them basically, while being invisible to the camera.
Fascinating.
And in the book, there's some wonderful example. There's one wonderful example of the many that exist of a mother who has disguise herself under a drape in order to hold the child still. these pictures just look weird.
Absolutely.
To us, but to them, not at all.
The book is chock full of, I have no idea if it's hundreds or thousands, it certainly feels like thousands of notable photographs from all over the years, and in many cases you also take us behind the scenes of some of these photographs as they were gathered together. I want to finish by asking you about this new age of the digital photograph and the fact that you say that photography has now become so commonplace and ubiquitous that it has lost its sense of the particular. So are we going to regain that, or is this the way it's forever going to be when it comes to photography?
Yes, that was one of my philosophical moments that escaped the editor's razor, that one. I think we've lost a sense of the particular in a number of ways. I think, for one thing, there are probably around 3 billion photographers on the planet now. Okay, there are 3 billion camera phones. For another, us photographers around the world, we make about 1.5 trillion images a year. All right, I'll let that soak in. 1.5 trillion. So that's a lot of knots. That's a lot of pictures every second of the day. And in addition to that, we have pictures which are now basically they are connected. We make one picture, and if we show it to our family on Facebook or friends, then potentially it's actually available to thousands, if not millions. Mm. So that's the sense in which I think we have lost the sense of the particular, that actually they are, photographs are now increasingly really, really thin slices of our existence. There was a time when it, because of film or the technologies or actually just the sheer cost of making a picture, we were very particular about the time slice that we chose in which we made the picture. But now that we just slice through our lives any old how, simply because we can.
Well, this book gives us so much to think about and to enjoy. Again, it's titled Photography, the Definitive Visual History, published by DK. Tom Eng, thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your amazing book.
It's been a great pleasure. Great pleasure.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we're going to be talking with two people who are heavily involved in a project to rehabilitate the baseball diamond at Case High School in Racine. We're also going to be hearing a portion of an interview with the author of a book called Dust to Deliverance, which tells the largely untold story of the extraordinary maritime evacuation of Manhattan that occurred on 9/11, when hundreds of thousands of people were evacuated from Lower Manhattan via the water. And on Wednesday, we'll be talking with two citizens from Charlottesville, Virginia, about recent events there. One of those guests,